What's the best part of a Dunkin' Run? The coffee? Is it the coffee or the $1 donut or $2 stuffed bagel minis or $3 sausage, egg, and cheese that you can add to it? The answer, of course, is yes. Time for a Dunkin' Run. $3 offer available on sausage, egg, and cheese sandwich only. Excludes specialty donuts and fancies. Offer valid on medium or larger coffee. Price and participation may vary. Limited time offer terms apply.
This is Ted Price, founder and CEO of Insomniac Games. I'm here on behalf of the Academy of Interactive Arts and Sciences. And recently, I had the pleasure of talking to Brendan Green, who's the creative director of PlayerUnknown's Battlegrounds. Brendan shared his thoughts on what it's like to be a creative director on one of the fastest growing franchises in our industry today. He also talked a lot about the transition from working on his own to moving in with a team in Korea who is now behind this incredible game. Brendan is a super nice guy, and for me, it was just a lot of fun sharing thoughts on his strategies for not only developing the game, but playing the game. I think you guys are going to love this. I learned a lot, and I hope you do too.
Welcome to the Game Maker's Notebook, a podcast featuring a series of in-depth one-on-one conversations between game makers providing a thoughtful, intimate perspective on the business and craft of interactive entertainment. The Game Maker's Notebook is presented by the Academy of Interactive Arts and Sciences, a member-driven organization dedicated to the recognition and advancement of interactive entertainment.
I'm Ted Price. I'm here with Brendan Green, who is PlayerUnknown, and it is my honor to be talking to you as a fan of your game, as I'm not alone in being a fan of your game.
Yeah, we have one or two.
Yes.
But thanks for having me and a pleasure to be here.
Right on. Well, as a fellow developer, there are a lot of questions that I've wanted to ask you about how you have created the game and what you've experienced in what has been, I think, a fairly unique journey.
Yeah, I mean, we didn't expect to be on this journey, and it's been an insane 5 months. I mean, it was a pretty hectic year developing the game, but the last 5 months have been intense.
I still can't believe it's 5 months. It's 5 months and you have how many players right now?
We still have a million CCU peak. We just passed a million piece CCU peak last weekend or this weekend? Last weekend. And we're maintaining it now through the week as well. So it's an insane number of people.
Has it sort of reshaped your own reality when it comes to how you think of the game industry?
Not really, because as I said, like I'm not from the industry. You know, I was a photographer and a DJ and a graphic designer for most of my life, and I wasn't in the industry, so I had no conceptions about it. You know, I'd kind of seen like it from the outside as a consumer, but now getting into it and coming here and meeting like, you know, the actual industry has been fantastic.
Well, we're here at DICE Europe, and I can tell you that after hearing you talk and your interview with Min yesterday, I think a lot of us were sort of rethinking how we approach making games and what it means to be successful. And just hearing your story, I think, helped us all sort of reframe maybe what we think about when we're building our next IP.
Sure. I mean, we've seen that kind of effect of like, you know, people not copying us, but doing similar ideas to us. And I think, yeah, we've kind of taken the industry by shock and kind of like no one expected this. And I've been talking to some friends in the industry and they said they didn't think the game was going to be a success, and they were happy to eat their words. And we don't quite know why we've been successful, which we're still trying to figure that out. But
well, I have some questions related to that. Yeah. I mean, at Insomniac, a bunch of us play PUBG, and it's a lot of fun for us. But I also find myself, and we discuss this, asking, what is it about survival games that is so compelling? And how, what do you think it is about DayZ and Arma and PUBG that have struck a chord with players?
Well, for me, the reason I loved DayZ and the DayZ mod and still do is because there are no rules. There's the rules of the world that you have to follow. But apart from that, there's no story. There's no linear path you have to go down. It's whatever the hell you want to do. And I think that's a reason PUBG has been successful, is because we don't give restrictions on how you finish the game. You know, we have the world, we have the weapons, and we have the blue zone. And apart from that, you can run around in your underpants with a frying pan if you want to. And this is like, it's just that freedom that players have, that we're not sort of trying to pigeonhole them into playing a certain way. It's, you can play however you want. And that's what draws me to survival games, is that it's up to you to survive, and there's nothing else but your decisions that affect you. So, you know, that's what drew me, and I think that's what draws a lot of people to it.
What do you think about the theme of survival in face of overwhelming odds? Is that also something that's important?
Oh, for sure. I mean, I think everyone, like especially me as a young boy, you know, loved playing army, loved playing that survival type thing. And I think, you know, it's kind of inherent in everyone to kind of, you know, I can be a great survivor. You know, I can be the one that can survive for 3 weeks without dying. And I think everyone has that kind of opportunity or thinking. And in a game like DayZ, you can do that. You know, I've read like stories on the Reddit and stuff like that of like the hermit of one town that like he was survived for like 3 months on the same character, you know, and took pride in it. And this kind of idea that I'm a better survivor than you, I think is kind of inherent in human nature, not just in games.
Do you think, though, that there needs to be some sort of inciting incident that's explained to help frame this need to survive or not? I mean, PUBG obviously doesn't have one.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think so. I mean, I think for me, it, like when we were creating the map and the game system, it was like freedom. You know, it was just like we just create a very simple set of rules and let the players do whatever they want. And I think that's, yeah, that's what draws me to survival games, is that freedom. It's that there are rules there, but there's no rule to tell you where to go and what to do.
Well, I think it's fascinating because coming from a more story-driven game perspective, where we build games that are driven by story,
sure,
that is something we would probably never do or never even think to do, because our assumption is, well, players have to understand what the enemy's motivation is. And in this case, really, there isn't any enemy, and there doesn't need to be a motivation.
Yeah.
And I think that's what's so, I think you're right, that freedom, that ability to make up your own story is one of the super compelling aspects of PUBG for me.
Oh, I mean, I've heard it all weekend from people telling me their stories from PUBG and their amazing experience. And you see it online with like highlight reels and all this kind of stuff, where this idea that, you know, every game you play in PUBG is different. And every time you have an experience, like PC Gamer did an article where they were talking about like kind of the map memory, that like you come into a role into a certain part of the map and you're like, oh fuck, I died here, or like I remember something crazy that happened here. And PUBG just gives you that opportunity to have a story to tell your friends, and I think that's one of the reasons people find it so compelling.
What about constraints? I mean, PUBG seems to be about very, very non-hidden constraints.
Yeah.
And how did those evolve when you were designing the game?
Well, so I've had 4 years to kind of plan out Battle Royale from way back in DayZ, the DayZ mod, up through Arma 3. And all the way through, the system was quite simple, and I kind of kept it like that. Like the talk that we just saw with the guys from Housemark, where they said, you know, two buttons and two controllers, and that was their limit. And it's the same with me when it came to Battle Royale, is that I had like a very basic system, and apart from tweaking and tuning that, I was never adding stuff to it because it worked.
Were you tempted to add, though?
Not really.
Really?
You know, because I had, so with my first DayZ mod server, I made it too complex. So I had crafting, I had all this kind of stuff to get higher tier weapons that I eventually added in, and I saw the player numbers drop. So when I entered into Battle Royale, I kind of went, okay, I'm going to keep this simple, and I'm not going to keep adding stuff just for the sake of adding stuff to make it new and interesting. I added new game modes and new ways to play it, but the core system, the game design, stayed the same, because I really felt that it worked, and if it's not broke, don't fix it. And we did add some stuff when we went into PUBG, like the revive feature, which was inspired, and that what didn't come from me, that came from our executive producer. He said this would be a nice little feature, and initially I was hesitant. I was like, well, you know, I don't want to mess with the game mode too much, this may lead to some bad stuff, but it turned out to be great. And you know, I was hesitant about adding stuff in the early days, but now, you know, I have such a great team that I let them not have the run of themselves, but like they kind of take ownership and stuff, and they'll convince me this is a good idea, and we do it, and it's been great. It's been a great experience.
What has it been like working with a team that came on after you created the initial concept and the really the proof of concept.
No, it was tough because they were, you know, professional game designers. Right. And I was breaking a lot of rules when it came to game design, especially because I was punishing players. And it was like, you know, if you're a bad player, you should die. And this is not something they were used to, especially in MMORPGs and stuff. They were kind of like, you know, you can't. And we had some very spirited discussions, but, you know, I kind of made my point and they were like, okay, I get what you're saying. And now it's kind of been like, I've been kind of vindicated. It's like, okay, look, this does work, you know?
What was the most difficult argument you had?
What was it? To make it more like Arma and not H1.
Okay.
That, like, in the first few meetings, you know, I got kind of called up that I was mentioning Arma too much. And they were like, we're not making an Arma clone. And I was like, I understand that. It's never something I wanted to do, you know? If you want Arma 3B, or it's there. If you want H1, it's there. I wanted to get somewhere in the middle, but I wanted that sort of big weapon selection and stuff like that. And they were worried, you know? They were worried, like, this is too complex. You know, people won't get this. It's too hardcore. And luckily, people got it. And, you know, we are where we are today.
Did you have any designers in particular who brought with them specific baggage when it comes to shooters?
No, I mean, none of our designers, our team really were into shooters. They were an MMORPG company. Yeah. And it was one of my concerns at the start, but, you know, I saw their methodology and I saw the way that they wanted to make well-made games. So, you know, that gave me confidence. And then sitting down with them and hearing their ideas, but they do play a lot of shooters now. Like the whole team plays Battlegrounds religiously. Like there's always two or three people playing in the office, and not because they have to, just because they love playing it. You know, it's great in the office that, you know, if someone gets into the top 10, you know, people start coming over from other parts of the office and watching him, and kind of like, if he wins, a big cheer goes up, you know? But it has been kind of tough working because I have no experience in game design. You know, I made a game mode, right, but I didn't understand the rules.
Well, I loved your interview in Rolling Stone where you were very clear about your background and mm-hmm. how this just isn't something that you had anticipated doing. And
yeah,
it's not your profession. But were you ever tempted just to keep on going on your own and just do it all, even if it took 10 times?
Oh, no. Well, I mean, this was it. I was, when I sort of finished with H1 and I would kind of concentrate it back in Arma 3B, or I was getting to a point going, you know, is this going to go somewhere? You know, I was like, I really want to make my own game, but I don't have the experience to sit down and you know, make a game by myself. You know, I know some people that do, but it takes years, you know, and I knew that I needed a team that had the experience to do it because, you know, making a battle royale is not cheap and it's, you know, you need a team to do it because of everything that's involved. And
what was the biggest benefit? Was it art assets? Was it programming chops? What did the team bring that was even most valuable to you?
Experience. It was experience. It was them being able to, and especially with my boss, that like I would have some ideas and he kind of go, no. You know, and explain why. Hmm. And he's very receptive to ideas. Like you can tell him any idea, go for a cigarette, like talk about something and he'll think about it. And there's some ideas he just, yeah, let's do that. You know, and others like, no. And then he goes, because of this. And that's so, like, I feel so lucky to have that like he's like a mentor to me in like my journey to become a good creative director, you know, because
that's really interesting. Okay.
Yeah. Like, I mean, I've asked him on multiple occasions, you know, like, can you just like write me some letters or something like that to explain to me, you know, what it's good to be a good leader, to be a good director. Because coming from being a mod maker where I did everything myself, mm-hmm. well, not everything myself, but I did a lot of the grunt work myself. And I had help, but, you know, I always had my hands in I did the art, you know, I did some of the programming, I did everything like that. And then coming to be a creative director where I had to kind of stand off and outline a vision and then a team do it. You know, and that was really hard for me.
Well, that's what a great step. I know I've heard so many stories that are completely the opposite, mm-hmm. where somebody has a vision for a game and he or she decides that they want to do it all.
Yeah.
And do. And there are a lot of smaller indie games that come out.
Oh, where sure.
It is that vision. I think it's really interesting that you decided to step into a corporate hierarchy, a larger team, mm-hmm. and even, it sounds like, abdicate some control over the game.
Oh, for sure. I mean, I had to, and I was happy to do it because they understood that I didn't have a lot of experience in the industry and they wanted to help. You know, they really wanted to go, okay, well, we can't do that because of this. We can't do this because of that. But it also gave me a lot of freedom because I didn't know the engine and I didn't know what was possible. So I could like dream a little bit bigger and like suggest things that the tech director would not like me for, but you know, there are good ideas in the game. Like, you know, the destructible doors and stuff like this, you know, they hated me for suggesting that because it's really intensive on the server. But you know, like we had problems with the server where we didn't realize that the red zone was basically destroying every door in the red zone. So it was like killing server performance, right? And little things like that. But we've got that all resolved. But, you know, having the team like that, that are willing to support me, but and handing off control was tough, and letting people, like, you know, do their own thing was really tough. But it's led to an amazing game, you know, because I've just trusted them now. There are some things I still need to go back and kind of bring down the creative director hammer and kind of go, we need to fix this. But, you know, overall, I'm happy with the team. Like, they just know what the vision for the game is. You know, as I said, yeah, I could leave the team now and the game would get finished at the way that I wanted it to, because they're so happy with the vision.
It's so funny you say that, because I play it and I think, this game's finished.
Yeah.
I know you're adding more.
Oh, no, we're going to be like, as like game as a service, permanent beta. You know, we'll go into launch, but we're still not going to be finished. So as we said, we have new maps coming. We still want to get the vaulting system in, which we hope to get out in November, I think. And then I'm trying to think what else we want to put in, like the 3D and 2D replays and this kind of stuff. So there's a few other systems in the game that we've promised to put in, and we want to get them in at full launch. But then that's not going to stop us. You know, there's other stuff that I want to put in and just polish to things, like, you know, animations for getting in and out of cars and all this little polish to make the game, as Pixar say, you know, bumping the lamp.
Actually, I want to just drill down on that for a second. Mm-hmm. When you say animations for getting in and out of cars, this is a game where you got to be fast, right?
Yeah.
I mean, every second counts when somebody's nearby.
Sure.
How do you balance that? You want to make it look good, right? But at the same time, it needs to be responsive.
Yeah, I mean, I'm when I say getting in and out of cars, that might not be correct. We might not be doing that. But, you know, animations for example, switching seats.
Yeah.
But just these little bits of polish to kind of give that real feel,
yeah,
you know? And jumping out of cars, we want like jumping and rolling animations, mm-hmm, so you can get out of car at speed and all these kind of little things that we just want to polish the game off. Yeah, it's a pretty complete game right now, but like the custom games feature still needs to be fleshed out and all this kind of extra stuff that's not just the game, because we want to give like anyone who buys the game this like complete service and not just a single game mode.
Well, so how do you prioritize though? Which of those features you really do want to put the time into? Because I'm sure you hear a lot from players, uh-huh, about what they like and what they don't like. And then you have your own vision for where the game's going to, mm-hmm, go. How do you make that call? And how does the team make that call?
We use data but we also kind of internally prioritize, like, this is not like, you know, animations for switching seats is not a critical feature, you know, that, yeah, it will change gameplay a little, but it's not critical, you know, and that's the way we look at things, is like, okay, this would be nice to have, but we don't need it for launch, because we have kind of the vision of what we want for launch. Right. And that's like the complete game at launch. So everything else, if we have time, we can get it in. If not, we just wait until after launch when we can kind of, you know, get stuff in. Because as we said, we want to be here for 5 years. So like people think, oh, the game's out now and that's it. And it's like, no, we want to be like CS, where like the CSGO you see now compared to like CS 1.6 are just completely different games. And I'm sure the game that you'll see in 10 years will be just completely different to the game you have now, which I can't wait for.
Is your goal to have something that feels real?
Oh, yeah. I mean, even with our new map, we're really taking the time to make sure that it's a much more realistic feel. Like, I mean, I've always said I wanted it to be in a pulp universe, that it's realistic, but not super realistic. So, like, you get hit with a shotgun, you get blown backwards. Mm-hmm. You know, these little things to add that kind of cinematic feel. And I think that really helps for the viewership, because it feels like you're watching like a live action movie, you know, and we wanted to get it to that stage where it really feels like super real in the game.
Well, that's interesting though, because in real life, you get shot, you're not going to be walking around.
So exactly.
It is, I guess it is that cinematic reality that we're all sort of looking for. We struggle with that too at Insomniac, where we talk about photoreal or realism, mm-hmm, and we don't really dissect it too often, but it's that filmic reality versus real life, because real life isn't that exciting.
No.
In real life, weapons are terrifying.
Yes.
Right? So.
Oh, well, this is it. Like, I mean, even with our, like, you know, time to kill and stuff like that, it's a little bit long, because even with Arma 3BR, I wanted it that if you're in a fight with someone, that it lasts a little bit longer than your average shooter, because then you feel like you've done well. It's like the 1% issue with, like, Doom and stuff, where it's more than 1%, you know? And with that time to kill, you want that kind of feel that I've been in a firefight, but I survived, and maybe I'll win the next one, you know? And yeah, it's that sort of cinematic universe that I think it's always what I've always wanted for a game, because it's more fun with explosions.
Absolutely. Yeah. More exciting.
Cool. Yeah.
So being a part of a Korean company now, how has PUBG sort of crossed cultural barriers? Because it does feel like a very Western game to me.
Sure.
But you've got, is it fully Korean team? Everybody there except for you is?
No. So there's what, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, about 7 people now on the team. That are, there's a Ukrainian guy, a Russian guy, 2 Poles, Turk, I think.
Okay.
And Spanish, 2 Spanish guys. And we're like expanding the team even further. You know, we're opening offices in Europe and LA to really get the best people from all over the world to work on the game, because it's quite hard to find particular engineers in Korea because everyone wants to work on mobile. So, you know, we're trying to be as multinational as possible, basically. We're looking for the best people. That's the key.
Do those cultural origins, mm-hmm. different cultural origins, have an influence on what goes into the game?
Funnily, yeah. So like with the map design, we were making fields, and the fields had these dips in them, like with these little ridges. And I was like, why are we doing this? And they said, because you need to have water in your field so the plants can grow. I'm like, but it's in Russia. They have rain. You know, you don't need to worry about this. And they were like, oh, and little things like that, that like they wouldn't necessarily like understand what realism meant, because they're fantasy designers more than anything else. And the same, like as I said yesterday, we were looking at designing uniforms, and, you know, they were looking at some Hugo Boss uniforms that would not have been the best uniforms to use.
Didn't know Hugo Boss made uniforms.
Yes, he did, very famously for a very particular party in Germany. And oh yeah, they were all Hugo Boss. But they were looking at these uniforms going, these look great. And because they're from Korea, they don't really associate, you know, with that sort of Western history, so to speak.
Yeah.
So, you know, I had to pull them up and go, no, we can't make them look like this. Like, seriously, like you don't understand. And little things like that, they're not really familiar all that much with Western culture. So I have to pull them back a few times on these things. But, you know, overall, they spend so much time kind of just reading and watching, you know, Western, where the like islands are based and stuff, and like going on Google Maps and just taking trips on Google Maps to kind of to see what the landscape is like. So,
well, I feel dumb asking this. These are actual islands that exist.
No.
Okay.
So
you're using reference.
Yeah. So we'll pick a region, and then we'll like with the current island, the terrain artist spent about a week reading a book called The Trees of Crimea. So just like seeing what trees grow in certain areas, just to pick out the right kind of trees to get made. So, and he's doing this with the new island as well. Like he's taking lead on the desert island, and he's Spanish and really has that appreciation of what a realistic space looks like. And, you know, it's been great kind of trying to get the art team into that mentality that, you know, when you're designing a real space, you have to like tell the story of why this town exists. You know, why is there a car here, and this kind of stuff. And it's great because seeing them like learn and grow, and like everything they're doing now is much more realistic, that I have to kind of say less basically and kind of go, okay, this is great.
Yeah. Well, okay. So a dumb question, and you may have answered this before, but why Russia?
So first of all, I just love that kind of architecture. I love the brutalist architecture. I think it looks really cool. I'm a big fan of that. It was just the initial design pitch I made for it, which was like on a forgotten island in the Black Sea, you know, the ultimate fight, or the ultimate life and death fight, live on Saturday nights, PlayerUnknown's Battlegrounds. That was kind of the pitch I made. And it just stuck in the Crimean. And one of the reasons I chose brutalist architecture was because it has less polygons. It's pretty much straight. So I thought, okay, this is going to be good for developing, you know, optimizing the game if we have. So there was kind of me liking the region, but also me thinking, okay, you know, we maybe should do more simple buildings because it's better for performance.
It makes me think back to Half-Life 2. You know, Half-Life 2, when it was at the time, mm-hmm. An incredibly... It's an amazing achievement technically, but
yeah,
that was, they did use brutalist architecture, and they set it in an area where
right.
you expected it. It looked like it fit. So that makes a lot of sense. It also kind of makes sense that maybe this is the kind of thing that would happen.
Right. I mean, I've seen, someone sent me a link maybe last year saying there was this Russian TV show that was like a live action battle royale where like people would be killing each other, you know? And it's like, okay, but only in Russia.
Right.
Or maybe Japan. But anyway.
So one of the things we do at Insomniac is discuss strategies. And
sure.
I have to ask the master, do you have a particular strategy or set of strategies when you play that works best for you?
Well, so for me, the design of the game that I have in my head is that first initial 10, 15 minutes is for looting, right? It's
right.
like, stay the fuck away from players, right? It's you know, it's for getting geared. It's for when you're in this, the fight should be happening in those circles and not at the start. You know, if you're going looking for trouble at the start, it's fine. You know, you're free to do that. And I think that's the joy of the game, that you can play whatever strategy you want. But for me, it's get the hell away from players, land, get geared, and then be sneaky. You know, get into the circle and pick your battles. You know, it's like, just because you see someone doesn't mean you have to kill them. You know, it's like someone else might take a shot and then you've got the position of two people, right? And it's those decisions of, you know, patience. As I said, I compare it to poker because it is patience. You know, it's waiting until you have like an opportunity to kill someone that you know that you're on top. You know, it's, yeah, it's a game of patience and a game of good decisions.
But is there a point for you in most of the games, some maybe halfway through, mm-hmm. 3/4 of the way through, where you start going into aggressive mode?
No, I'm super pacifist.
Really? So
do you hide?
Wait until exactly the last possible second to engage?
Yeah. It's like, it's about surviving, and the smart man hides. You know, if you're going to go into a fight, there's a chance you're going to lose, right? So for me, it's like, and I know it's kind of boring, you know, and people don't like playing that way. But for me, it's not about how many kills you get. It's about if you win or not, you know?
Well, that's an interesting point, because I think a lot of players are coming from FPSs where it is about the number of kills.
Oh, for sure. Uh-huh.
And I'm sure that explains what you see going on around you during the first 5 minutes.
Oh, for sure. I mean, you get a lot of the H1 players that are kind of like, they want it more like H1, where it's super high powered action and stuff. But for me, that's not what Battle Royale is. You know, it's about having the downtime, because it's a stressful enough game as it is. And, you know, and even in first person, it's even more stressful. But, you know, it's about like having that downtime, so you're not always on the edge of your seat. You know, it is kind of a horror game because of the jump scares, but you know, it is meant to be kind of slower at the start, and how you play it's up to you, but I prefer being a pacifist.
I have to admit, I'm right there with you. Mm-hmm. My favorite part is finding a sniper rifle, finding a good perch, and just hunkering down.
Yes.
And hoping that nobody else is going to, you know, come anywhere near. Do you have a favorite weapon?
Scar and M24.
Okay.
Yeah. I love the Scar. Although, since we've added the Groza, I think like the Groza is my favorite assault rifle. The thing just destroys people. You know, it's called Thunder for a reason.
Yeah. Well, is it so? Do you place them in according to their power and make them more scarce?
Yeah. So the Groza is crate only, because it's a 7.62 automatic rifle and it's super accurate. But yeah, so we have, the loot system was developed all the way through Armor 3, and I don't want to go into too many specifics, but it's pretty nice, because, as you know, in low value areas, you can still have a chance to get a high value weapon. And it's that kind of, you rock into a house, it's like, oh my God, it's an AK. Yes.
Well, those are those moments, right, that are memorable. And I think that's really cool that you do that.
Yeah, no, and that's like a loot system that's been kind of planned since Armor 3, where it is random, but it's random within pretty specific limits. So like, you know, we want to get it, and we're using data to really tune this, and we'll be tuning the loot system over time, because tuning the loot based on player feedback is just, you're going down a rabbit hole, because everyone has their own experience. And I experienced it all through Armor 3, where Lyric would comment every few weeks that we've changed the loot system, and we never touched it, you know. And it was just this idea that because it's that random, that you get a different experience every time. So now we're starting to tune it with data, and really having the data science team do lots of lovely graphs and showing us, you know, who uses what weapon and the percentage of stuff, and we'll start tuning it on that.
Well, can you break it down a little bit for our listeners, mm-hmm. just so we can understand at a high level, what's the first thing that you look at when it comes to making a change about, say, the scarcity of a weapon?
I'm going to be honest here, and I'm not really sure. So that's the lead game designer's kind of decisions. Like, I leave that up to him. But what we're looking at generally is like the spread of AK, or the spread of, like, say, assault rifles, mm-hmm. Across the island. We have lovely spreadsheets that tell us roughly where everything is, and it gives us kind of an outlying thing. And then we'll look at how many people are actually using assault rifles within the game, and seeing how many are going unused. And then maybe we need to tweak that a little bit to up the assault rifle level, just so more people are using them. So it's stuff like this, just like looking at the hard data of like what weapons are used, how many weapons are used, how many weapons are unused and just left in places, and seeing if there's any dead areas on the map that people really don't go to. And, you know, we added a new town over by the mountain, because people just didn't go there because there was nothing there. So little things like that, the data can kind of go, okay, we can improve by changing this slightly or just changing that slightly.
Well, is it true then that, because this may be totally wrong, that if an area looks like it's a, not just a house or a collection of houses on its own, but it's a prison or mm-hmm. a plant, nuclear plant, you're going to get better weapons there?
Yeah. So, I mean, like the military areas, and there are like, you know, the crate area in George Pool, like there mm-hmm. are areas that are have a higher chance to spawn high value loot.
That's good to know, because I assumed that was the case, but I also thought it might have been just random.
No. I mean, there's high value and low value areas, but even in the low value areas, you can still have a chance to get high value stuff. And in the high value areas, you get a chance to get low value stuff, which is sometimes you go to military and you get dick, because that's just the way the system's set up, that you're never guaranteed to get what you want. And that's what I wanted from day one, is like, you know, I don't want you to land on a map and know I can get, oh, I want my AK, I want my M24, and I want this, and you can get it within 5 minutes.
Right.
You know, it's like, I want you to start to think, you know, because shit, I've only got a pan and a shotgun. What the fuck do I do now? You know, and it's this idea that it's, you know, that's why I created this, was to test you as a tactical thinker rather than just knowing the map and the weapons.
Do you also track when people jump out of the plane?
Oh yeah, we track everything.
So what have you seen trends? Or is there a type of player that jumps out immediately and then one that waits till the very, very end?
No, I mean, we haven't really done a lot of digging into this, because like the data science team, they have enough on their plate. They're still trying to figure out our sales curves. But yeah, I mean, we will be looking at that more and more. Like we have so much data in the back end now, like that is just stored and logged. And yeah, we're going to be looking at everything just to, like, I mean, we're pretty happy with the plane right now. I mean, I think most people will jump over Puchinki or school. I think that's the more popular areas, you know, and that's a lot of people just wanting to learn the game, because, you know, if you go to those high populated areas, you'll learn the game quick.
Right.
You know, and you'll learn, okay, this is how I do this. And then as people learn the game, you see them going just further afield and like getting the hell out of that area and going away from everyone else. So, you know, I like that about the game, that there is that sort of inherent skill curve or skill gap.
So one more data question. Mm-hmm. I promise I won't ask any more after this. What is the sort of the breakdown between the aggressive players mm-hmm. and those who are like you and me, who kind of hang back and camp or hide?
I honestly don't know, because we don't have all that. Well, we have the data, but like IGN did a big infographic on us. Mm. And most of the data we had to kind of extrapolate, because we have so much data that it takes literally like a week to pull X amount of data. You know, it's crazy. Like they just can't pull all the data we need right now just because of the way it's stored. They can't. So when it comes to questions, I can't give answers, because I really don't know.
If at some point down the road when you have gone through it, it would be really fun for fans.
Oh no,
to
I
understand.
Want. Yeah, I want like I want heat maps. I've talked to the guys already to get heat maps of like deaths on the island and maybe jump positions and all this kind of stuff to really, because I love that data. We had it in Arma 3 BR. We had like heat map data showing deaths and weapons and all kinds of stuff, and I love seeing that, and I want to share that with people. So don't worry.
Great.
Yeah, we will have stats for people. You know, I love stats. So. And I know people love stats. So,
okay, well, here's another sort of noobish question. Mm-hmm. Given that you play the game a certain way, and you, in some ways, the game rewards you for hiding, et cetera.
Sure.
When it comes to scoring, mm-hmm. right? What do you actually reward kills on a? I mean, do you encourage kills through points as much? Okay.
Well, no. So I mean, we found I think current system is that like you get 20% of your kill points. So like you get like the same kill and win points, but then you won't, when the total is calculated, you only get 20% of your kill points.
Okay.
And it's to encourage that it's not about kills.
Yeah.
It's about winning, you know? So we made some changes in the invitation, which we need to roll back and do it again, but we don't want to overly reward kills. Like, kills are important, and yes, they're good for ranking up, and we want to reward people who are, you know, aggressive, but at the end of the day, it's about winning, and it's about your placement. Yeah. And that's what the game, to me, should be about. It shouldn't be about how many kills you can get.
Makes sense.
Because, you just don't want to drive that aggressiveness. You know, you want to let people play however they want.
True. In some ways, if you are driving the aggressiveness, mm-hmm. but you have a certain type of player that will just, they'll wipe each other out.
Yeah.
So it is a benefit potentially for the others.
Well, this is it. I mean, I just feel that if we give kills too high a rating, it just encourages aggressive play. And we don't want to encourage any particular type of play.
Yeah.
Like, kills are still important, but we want to let anyone play whatever way they want. And you're not kind of, as I said, pigeonholing them into a certain way of playing.
And for vehicles, right? Mm-hmm. Have you had a lot of say, debates with the team over vehicle speed, vehicle type?
We did where have, vehicles can go. Yeah, no, we had some talk about, like, because our lead game designer, JC, he's just an amazing designer. Like, the guy does so much research over everything. Like, I mean, between spreadsheets and Wikipedia, the guy just, like, has about 20 windows open at once, just, like, reading on whatever topic. And he spent months doing the vehicle physics. Like, really? I mean, I think he drove about 20,000 kilometers in the game, you know, just driving and driving and driving. And then we made some tweaking to it afterwards because he wanted to keep them very real. And I was like, no, we can make them a little bit less real just because it's more fun if they're not super real. So we've tweaked them a little bit, but like credit to him, he got them feeling so good. Yeah. You know, like I was watching someone give a review, what was his name? War Owl, I think it is. He's like a WoW reviewer or something. But, you know, he played the game. He's like, it's great. You know, I drive cars. Cars in the game feel great. You know, and it's a credit to JC. Just hours and hours and days and months of just sitting down driving the same car. You know, he doesn't want to do it anymore. But
does he do them in real life? Does he go out and find those
cars? Oh, yeah. No, he loves his car. He rocks like a BMW 5 Series or something. Like, he loves his cars. So
you should have a BMW 5 Series in the game.
No.
Oh, no. Wouldn't that be great? Just to drop one in every now and then.
Well, actually, we are adding some new cars to the new map, map-specific vehicles, basically. And one of them is a sports car, and that's all I'll say.
That's great. Was there ever a time where you thought maybe we shouldn't have vehicles in the game?
No.
Nope.
No, because, again, this was like, it's one of the, like, the core concepts for me for Battle Royale is that it's never hard to get into the blue zone. You know, it's a fight between you and me. It's not a fight against the environment. It's not a fight against the red zone. It's not a fight against vehicles. It's a fight between you and me. And giving people the ability to get into the blue zone easily by vehicles or whatever, it's just part of the game. You know, you don't want to be super restrictive on, making most people run, basically, which is just, it's boring.
Yeah, it gets a little old. Mm-hmm. Ever consider maybe any air vehicles?
No.
Nope.
No, I mean, we had in Arma 3B, or we had this game mode called War, Battle Royale War, and it had tanks and little birds. Now, when the Blue Zone started, I just killed the engine via script. So, you know, you couldn't use them once the Blue Zone started. But in that initial, death match, it was fun rocking around in a tank and little birds flying around. But for our Battle Royale, no, it's not. But I mean, once we open up modding eventually down the line, you know, people are going to put in air vehicles. People are going to do all this kind of stuff. So, you know, for us, it's about providing a great playground with a lot of assets. So you never know, we may do a helicopter, you know, just to do it, you know, so that the asset is there. But yeah.
Cool. So back to you and how you do things. What is your day-to-day life like?
For the last 3 months, it's been sitting in an airplane and going to conventions. Which I'm not going to complain about. You know, I'm basically the face of the game. I say, like, I'm the face of the game and the team is the heart and soul. You know, that I'm pretty much like the main English speaker on the team. So I do all the press. And it's my name on the game, which helps as well. But, you know, day to day, like, you know, I talk with the events and community team about, you know, what they're doing. And like, as I said, I leave the teams to be anonymous as much to work by themselves, not anonymous. So I listen to what they're planning and stuff like that. I might give some suggestions and stuff like that. But really, it's more kind of like yes or no at this stage. You know, they do the work and I'm kind of looking at it going, yeah, that's a great idea. Or no, maybe we should do this. And that's a great position to be in for me. Because as I said, I travel a lot.
Well, at this point, their travel will be over, right? You're going to finish up your PR tour and then go back, I'm assuming.
Well, no, because so we go for full launch at the end of the year.
Okay.
So I'll be traveling a bit more then. Even into next year. Because we're on Xbox Game Preview at the end of the year. So, you know, that's then the Xbox full launch. So for me, I don't see it kind of stopping for the next year. Oh, you know,
That to me sounds insane, but
I love it. I mean,
that's great.
You know, I'm tired all the time, and you know, my body never knows what time zone I'm in. But I get to meet my fans, you know, and that's an amazing thing. Like, because I've had like two meet and greets so far, and it's been just great. You know, and for me, it's I might be a little bit tired, and it's traveling for me, but you know, I know that giving the fans the chance to meet me, like, it means the world to them. And you know, and if I can do that, I want to do it as much as possible. You know, and I will sit there and listen to people's stories about my game for hours, you know, because they love telling me and I can see the passion in their eyes. And, you know, and I hear so many like game developers are a little bit standoffish and, you know, especially the higher tiered ones, you know, where they've had their fame and they're kind of like, no, you know, no, I don't want to talk to you. And me, it's like, I might get sick of it sometimes, but I'll still sit there and bear it because, you know, it means so much to those people.
Oh, that's great that you do that. And so when it comes to those interactions, mm-hmm. is there a question you get asked more often than any other?
Put an RPG into the game.
okay.
Why do you have third person?
well, that's a great question.
Yeah.
So at any point, did you think about, should we have first person or as an option, or should we just go first person, or was it always third person?
So in DayZ Battle Royale, the first mod I made, it was first person only.
Okay.
And then I went into Arma 3, and in first person, there's a... like, it just sounds like a 10-minute orgasm, basically, when you're hurt. And I hated that. And I was like, okay, I can't subject people to having that. Now, it's better now. But at the time, I was like, I just can't subject people to hearing that, like, all the time. So that's why I did third person.
Really? Well, yeah, yeah. I mean, that was one way to indicate damage, right? Could have been something on the HUD or...
Oh, yeah, but it was just inbuilt into Arma, and I couldn't change it.
Ah, got it. Okay.
Yeah, yeah. So because I couldn't change it, or I didn't have the knowledge to change it, maybe, I decided, listen, you know, we're going to have to do third person, and that's why third person exists in Battle Royale.
Well, I'll tell you, it
because
is...
Because I would have had it first person only, but...
Oh, you know, it's so great to be able to see what your character looks like when you're picking up all the equipment.
Oh, for sure.
I mean, that's a... It's we've struggled with that in Insomniac. When we were making Resistance, which mm-hmm. is a first person game, we assumed that people would know what Nathan Hale looked like, and... Of course, you don't, unless you see him in a cutscene.
Sure.
And it is, and today, when we look at all the other games that are out there, there has been a giant move towards third person.
And I mean, I think that comes from as well from cosmetics and stuff like that, yeah. where, you know, you want to see what your character is wearing. And also, in a multiplayer shooter, third person, and I'll get shit for this, but it is slightly easier, you know, because... you do feel a lot safer because you can look around and you can yeah. see what's around you, you know. Realistically, first person is probably safer because if you can't see them, they probably can't see you, you know?
Yeah.
And but third person, just people feel safer because you can look around corners and stuff like this. And it's funny because I hear it all the time. It's like, oh, you know, third person peeking and stuff like that. It's like, if you're playing third person, you should know about third person peeking. And if you like run up to a corner and get killed from someone peeking, that's your fault.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, we get it as well. Like, you know, people want the blue zone more opaque so people outside can't shoot in. And kill them from behind. It's like, well, you should be checking your six. You know, if you get killed from behind, that's not the game's problem. You know, that's your problem for not being... But people love to complain.
Well, do people generally complain that the game should be easier?
Yes.
Really?
Oh, I mean, you get... Not that you get, but like stuff like you should remove clothing from the game, like on the ground, right? It should only be weapons and items. And I'm like, no, you need the shit loot so you keep looting. Right.
Yeah,
you need to, and
I think that's such a great, I mean, that was such a great call because mm-hmm. you have to make strategic decisions all the time. Do I sit here and pick up this cosmetic shirt or do I
yeah.
keep on going? And you know what? I pick up the shirt just because I kind of want to see what it looks like.
Exactly. Right. And people love playing dress up in the game,
yeah.
you know, and, but for me, it was, I'm sorry. I'm afraid to forget the question.
Oh, I'm talking.
just went off and just brain fart and nothing.
No, it's okay. I think one thing I do want to get to, because I know there are a lot of people listening to this and wondering about how they can have the same sort of impact on the industry that you've
sure.
had. And as sort of a last question, what advice do you have for any aspiring creative directors, given that your journey has really been unique mm-hmm. And fantastic to hear about?
I mean, I'm in a really unique position, you know, and I really don't feel good giving advice because I've just been really lucky. You know, I've been kind of handed stuff on silver plates, you know, for the last 2 years.
Well, you had a vision for a game.
Oh, I mean, I worked hard. Like, as I said, the first 2 years of Battle Royale was me broke and paying for servers from social welfare. And it was that sort of, you know, I had that drive that I knew yeah. this could be an esport, you know, I knew, or a big thing, and I was committed to it, you know, and it was blind commitment.
Yeah.
It was like I was 30 odd and no career and doing this for free. And, you know, I wanted to do it because I loved doing it. And it was a game I liked to play. And I had this like belief that this could be something great. And
I think that is an absolutely appropriate lesson, because if you have the passion and the vision mm-hmm. for something and you don't give up, you will get it made.
Well, no, this is it. So this is something I've said like in most of my panels and stuff like that. At the end is like, number one, do something you want to play, right? And number two, make sure you fucking love doing it. Because like if it doesn't work out, you're not going to feel bad because you loved doing it, right? And yeah, it might be a bit disappointing at the end if it doesn't get made, but you won't have wasted time because you've loved doing it. And that's what I say is like, whatever you're doing, make sure you love it. You know, because if you don't, it's going to get strenuous and it's going to get, you know, you're going to get angry, you know, the more, if nothing happens, you know. And for me, because I loved doing it, I was always willing to wait because I knew, okay, there's something good here. And I think, you know, I can make this into something good. So, yeah, just, you know, it sounds so cheesy. It's like follow your dreams. But it really is like if you have a dream, just go and get it. You know, it's like, don't wait, you know, don't wait for someone else to help you or, you know, the next great thing to come along is just go and do it. And, you know, I would suggest, you know, Unreal can be slightly daunting, you know, to people, especially new people in the industry that have no idea about programming or level design or anything like this. And I opened Unreal and I was like, what the fuck, you know, and it's like, okay, how do I even start making a game on this? And I'd suggest, you know, look at engines like Arma and look at like moddable platforms that you can go in and test your idea essentially for free, you know, and it's relatively easy to get a mod set up or even a game mode in Arma or a mission. And Arma allows you to do everything, basically. There's no real restrictions. So, you know, if you want to test something, I would suggest do a mod of it first and see where it goes. Like, as I said, Arma gave us DayZ. It gave us Battlegrounds or the Battle Royale genre and a few other games. And, you know, I'm a great advocate of the platform because, you know, it helped me grow. And I think for somewhere to start, I think modding is a great start because you're not committed to making a full game and you can get a mod rolled out in a few months if you're quick, you know? And I think that's a great way to test your idea.
That is fantastic advice.
Thank you.
Well, Brendan, thank you so much for...
Oh, thanks for having me.
Chatting. This has been a lot of fun.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure talking to you. Right. And thanks for listening.
You got it.
Thank you for joining us for the Game Maker's Notebook. For more information on the Academy of Interactive Arts and Sciences, our podcasts, and our other initiatives, please visit www.interactive.org.
What's the best part of a Dunkin' Run? The coffee? Is it the coffee or the $1 donut or $2 stuffed bagel minis or $3 sausage, egg, and cheese that you can add to it? The answer, of course, is yes. Time for a Dunkin' Run. $3 offer available on sausage, egg, and cheese sandwich only. Excludes specialty donuts and fancies. Offer valid on medium or larger coffee. Price and participation may vary. Limited time offer terms apply.